Welcome to the Corner of Film podcast. I'm Niall from Corner of Film, which is a film website where I write about film. You are listening to the latest in a series of mini episodes that I make bi-weekly alongside the longer conversational episodes of the podcast. These minis are scripted, recorded, and edited by yours truly, and they give me a chance to share an insight into some of the weirder aspects of Hollywood. So far, we've looked at alleged curses, death in old Hollywood, and the nocturnal inspirations behind numerous films. When I say nocturnal, I mean dreams, not the other thing. For this week's episode, I've prepared a few of something I've tentatively titled Production Horror Stories. My first tale of nightmarish production actually has very little to do with the resulting film itself, but it makes for a dark and interesting story nonetheless. Quick heads up, I'm about to talk about a pretty grisly murder or two, or three, or four, or five, or six. If you're likely to find that upsetting, you might want to skip ahead. Once upon a time, Roman Polanski was a celebrated filmmaker. I know that must be hard to imagine, given the many years he's since spent eluding the authorities after being arrested for drugging and raping a 13-year-old girl, but back in 1969, he was coming off the back of writing and directing Rosemary's Baby, earning himself his second Oscar nomination. Polanski was preparing to direct a sci-fi thriller called Day of the Dolphin, and he travelled from his home in Los Angeles to London in order to scout out some filming locations. While Polanski was gone, however, his life changed forever. Now, this isn't a true crime podcast. I know that might be hard to believe, given that I did a whole episode on Hollywood deaths and I'm likely to do another, but I'm here to talk about film, so I'll keep this part brief. In 1969, after establishing a cult which he referred to as his family, Charles Manson instructed a number of his followers to go to the former home of record producer Terry Melcher and, in his words, totally destroy everyone inside. Melcher had previously snubbed Manson for a record deal, and he just happened to have lived in the house that Polanski now shared with his wife, actress Sharon Tate. I'm not going to go into the grisly details here, but Tate and her four guests of the evening were brutally murdered by the Manson family. Tate was also 8.5 months pregnant with Polanski's child. The boy was posthumously named Paul Richard Polanski. Naturally, Polanski abandoned the Day of the Dolphin, and he took a break from the director's chair. His much-anticipated return was an adaptation of Shakespeare's Macbeth, but he loudly and emphatically scoffed at the idea of making it a predictable costume drama. No, Polanski wanted to embrace and highlight the darker aspects of the Scottish play and make a disturbing and bleakly atmospheric film instead. His reasons, as he later wrote in his autobiography, were not only that he wanted to be true to the violent nature of Shakespeare's work, but that he knew his first project after the murder of his wife and son would be picked apart regardless. He knew that making anything light-hearted would make him seem callous. Polanski's proposed approach to the film wasn't met with much enthusiasm. In fact, both Paramount and 20th Century Fox passed on Macbeth, prompting an unexpected figure to step in and provide finance for the film, Hugh Hefner. Yes, that's Playboy's Hugh Hefner, the guy in the robe with the pipe and all the bunny girls. That's the man that financed Shakespeare when no one else would. You say pornographer, I say patron of the arts. After a production fraught with difficulty due to adverse weather conditions, seriously, a cameraman almost died after being blown off of a scaffold, Macbeth was released to very little enthusiasm due to its graphic violence and gratuitous nudity. However, in the years since, critical opinions of the film have improved significantly. Besides, Polanski's career was far from over. Chinatown, arguably his biggest hit, was just a few short years away. The story behind Macbeth, the murder of Sharon Tate and her unborn son, and Polanski's dark vision for Shakespeare's material, that's a real-life horror story. So, to ease you gently into the rest of the podcast, I'm going to talk about one of the most acclaimed thriller horrors ever made, Jaws. Jaws is actually based on a novel by Peter Benchley, also called Jaws, which in turn was inspired by the exploits of Frank Mundus, a New York fisherman who inspired the character of Quint. What many people don't know, however, is just how awful the film's production really was. In the years since its release, Jaws has been celebrated for the tension it creates, with the shark's presence suggested through clever directing and scoring as opposed to having it rear its ugly head every few scenes. No one wants that, honestly. Just watch Deep Blue Sea if you don't believe me. Originally, though, the plan was to do just that. The production had three mechanical sharks on hand for the film, except they were constantly malfunctioning. This forced the fledgling director, a young man named Steven Spielberg, to make the fateful decision to minimise the shark's on-screen presence, and thus a legendary film was born. Mechanical sharks were far from the only problem on set, though. You see, Jaws was shot on location, which meant the beach and the ocean, and nature made that quite unpleasant for the crew. The film's writer, Carl Gottlieb, was quoted as saying that the crew would come back from their 12-hour working days ravaged and sunburnt, windblown and covered with salt water. The actors also reported suffering from regular seasickness. Safe to say, they weren't the greatest working conditions for all of those involved. On top of all of those issues, Robert Shaw also caused more than his share of unpleasantness on set. The Quinn actor spent much of his time binge drinking, and in a number of his scenes he is visibly genuinely drunk. He also harboured a bitter grudge against co-star Richard Dreyfuss, and apparently repeatedly fled to Canada due to tax problems. Just to add to the stress, a number of life-threatening disasters also occurred during production. Gottlieb was almost decapitated by the boat's propellers, Richard Dreyfuss got trapped inside the steel shark cage, and while shooting the now famous final scene, the boat's hull ruptured. Now, I don't know much about boats, but I know that rupture is not a word that you want to hear while you're at sea. Naturally, the boat began to sink and the crew had to scramble to save the actors' lives. Originally, Jaws was given a budget of $4 million and was expected to take around 55 days to shoot. However, due to the many, many issues that arose during production, the budget more than doubled to around $9 million and the shoot ended up taking a staggering 159 days. That 104-day overrun led Spielberg to believe that his career was over and that he'd likely never work as a director again. Luckily, Jaws made back almost its entire budget in its opening weekend alone, and Universal quickly forgave the director. You'd think that after enduring all of that, Jaws would be the worst experience of actor Roy Scheider's career, but there's actually a film that Scheider made just 2 years later that he claimed made Jaws look like a picnic. Sorcerer is actually the second film to be based on Georges Arnaud's 1950 novel La Salaire de la Peur, the first being the excellent 1953 thriller The Wages of Fear. What Sorcerer had, though, was director William Friedkin, known for his unorthodox methods. Sorcerer tells the story of four outcasts who are assigned to drive a truck of incredibly unstable nitroglycerin 200 miles across the mountain roads of South America. The premise itself is pretty tense, but the film's production actually ended up putting it to shame. For the film's bridge scene, Friedkin had an actual bridge built over a river in the Dominican Republic, but before the scene was filmed, the river dried up. Friedkin wasn't willing to settle though, so relocated the shoot to Mexico and had the bridge rebuilt over another river there. Before the scene was filmed, that river also dried up. The 12-minute sequence ended up costing $3 million. That equates to roughly $13 million today, most of which presumably went on the construction of two separate bridges in two separate countries. Sorcerer's problems weren't all bridges and budget though. In fact, 50 members of the crew suffered from severe illness during production, with reports of food poisoning, malaria, and even gangrene. When asked about the production, Friedkin simply said, "There are just things over which we have no control, and that's one of the themes of Sorcerer. No matter how difficult your struggle is, there's no guarantee of a successful outcome." Callous words, but pretty accurate. Sorcerer was far from a box office success and failed to recoup the cost of its production, although Friedkin cites it as one of his best films, and it's since gone on to receive some critical acclaim. You might think that this reckless approach to realistically recreating the events of your film would have gone out of style after Sorcerer tanked at the box office, but there's always another mad director willing to put their cast and crew through hell in the name of art. 1982's Fitzcarraldo had one of the most notoriously difficult productions of all time. The film tells the story of a rubber baron determined to transport a steamship up a steep hill in order to access an untapped parcel of land. I'm sure you can see where this is going. Director Werner Herzog refused to shoot the all-important hill scene using miniatures and instead shot it for real, transporting a 320-ton ship uphill using a series of pulleys and rollers manned by dozens of extras. What's even stranger though is that carrying a ship uphill wasn't even the biggest hardship production faced. Originally, Jason Robards was cast as the titular rubber baron, with Mick Jagger appearing in a supporting role. However, after completing roughly 40% of the shoot, Robards contracted dysentery. After leaving to seek treatment, his doctors refused to allow him to return to the shoot. To make matters worse, Mick Jagger then had to leave to tour with the Rolling Stones, and so Herzog made the decision to recast the title role and start the film again, from scratch. He cast Klaus Kinski and wrote Jagger's character out completely, then began the shoot again. Before long, Kinski proved to be something of a liability, alienating practically the entire crew with his confrontational attitude. After Kinski repeatedly upset several of the film's native extras, a native chief approached Herzog and offered to kill Kinski. Herzog, to his credit, declined the offer. Using the natives as extras for the film might seem like a good thing, but it actually proved disastrous for just about everyone involved. There were numerous incidents on set, with many of the indigenous extras being injured or killed, as well as two small plane crashes which actually resulted in a case of paralysis. Additionally, there was an incident in which a Peruvian logger was bitten by a venomous snake, and he was forced to cut off his own foot with a chainsaw in order to survive. Herzog himself upset the locals too, though. He built a village on the Aguaruna tribe's land without permission, then attempted to have the local militia protect him when the tribe turned violent. In the end, the Aguaruna burned the film set down, and they shot an actor through the neck with an arrow for good measure. Honestly, Fitzcarraldo has one of the most interesting and insane production stories of all time, and it did at least meet with critical success. It was named one of the favourite films of noted critic Roger Ebert and revered Japanese filmmaker Akira Kurosawa, so you know that Herzog must have done something right. That brings us to the end of this week's podcast. I really hoped you enjoyed hearing about the suffering of these actors, directors, and film crews, and maybe that you've learned a little something too. Please don't forget that you can follow Corner of Film on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Corner of Film, and you can catch this podcast on Spotify, YouTube, Podbean, and now on Amazon Music too, which is very exciting. Please do drop us a rating, a like, a follow, a comment, or whatever you've got on your platform of choice. It will help this podcast reach more sets of ears, which I would greatly appreciate. I'll be back next week with my co-host Jack, but for now, as always, thank you so much for listening. I've been Niall from Corner of Film, and I need to come up with a good sign-off line. Goodbye!